This is a top to you know, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board.
Oh.
11, oh, 11,
and most of
11,
the
and then
amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes, you know, be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up,
yeah,
all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is, if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on The Horn. It's Boxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Boxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Your host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
Hey, everyone. Welcome aboard Foxed Up here for a Monday night or Tuesday afternoon, depending on where you reside in this planet. All right, everybody. Whoops, we kind of lost it there for a second, but we're back. Anyway, welcome aboard to Foxed Up here for a Monday night, Tuesday afternoon. We've got a whole bunch of stuff to go to get through tonight. I have a double track of the day, just because I couldn't make a decision. And I'll explain that in a minute. And then later, I've got the audio from an interview last night from Late Line. From the Australian ABC last night. Tony Jones interviewed Catherine Zoi, and she is the CEO of this group of environmental investors, Roddy Ra, headed up by Al Gore. Actually, Al Gore chose her to head up this thing. And it's an amazing interview where she discusses what you're going to see in the election when it kicks into full swing. I think it'll probably start after the primaries, dealing with the environment in the United States election. And she discusses why the environment does not rate so highly as an issue in the American election as it did in the Australian election. And I think you'll find it very, very interesting. And I've also got a little piece which, to me, a lot of the people that listen to this network have pets, and we all love our pets. And it's just a story about a cat. And maybe before I even go with the track of the day, I might just go ahead and read this. I came across this on Stumble yesterday, and I'm telling you, it put a lump in my throat. And it's just one of these things that shows that I think sometimes animals are much better spirits than us humans are. And this is from jerrystout.us, and it's just entitled Ugly the Cat. It says, everyone in the apartment complex I lived in knew who Ugly was. Ugly was the resident tomcat. Ugly loved three things in this world: fighting, eating garbage, and, shall we say, love. The combination of these things combined with a life spent outside had their effects on Ugly. To start with, he had only one eye, and where the other should have been, there was a hole. He was also missing his ear on the same side. His left foot appeared to have been badly broken at one time and had healed at an unnatural angle, making him look like he was always turning the corner. Ugly would have been a dark gray tabby, striped type, except for the sores covering his head, neck, and even his shoulders. Every time someone saw Ugly, there was the same reaction. That's one ugly cat. All the children were warned not to touch him. The adults threw rocks at him, hosed him down, squirted him when he tried to come in their homes, or shut his paws in the door when he would not leave. Ugly always had the same reaction. If you turned the hose on him, he would stand there, getting soaked until you gave up and quit. If you threw things at him, he would curl his lanky body around your feet in forgiveness. Whenever he spied children, he would come running, meowing frantically and bump his head against their hands, begging for their love. If you ever picked him up, he would immediately begin suckling on your shirt, earrings, whatever he could find. One day, Ugly shared his love with the neighbor's dogs. They did not respond kindly, and Ugly was badly mauled. I tried to rush to his aid. By the time I got to where he was lying, it was apparent Ugly's sad life was almost at an end. As I picked him up and tried to carry him home, I could hear him wheezing and gasping, and could feel him struggling. It must be hurting him terribly, I thought. Then I felt a familiar tugging, sucking sensation on my ear. Ugly, in so much pain, suffering, and obviously dying, was trying to suckle my ear. And I pulled him closer to me, and he bumped the palm of my hand with his head. Then he turned his one golden eye towards me, and I could hear the distinct sound of purring. Even in the greatest pain, that ugly, battled, scarred cat was asking only for a little affection, perhaps some compassion. At that moment, I thought Ugly was the most beautiful, loving creature I've ever seen. Never once did he try to bite or scratch me, try to go get away from me, or struggle in any way. Ugly just looked up at me, completely trusting me to relieve his pain. Ugly died in my arms before I could get inside, but I sat and held him for a long time afterwards, thinking about how one scared, deformed, little stray could so alter my opinion about what it means to have true pureness of spirit, to love so totally and truly. Ugly taught me more about giving and compassion than 1,000 books, lectures, or talk show specials ever could, and for that I will always be thankful. He has been scarred on the outside, but I was scarred on the inside, and it was time for me to move on and learn to love truly and deeply, to give my total to those I cared for. Many people want to be richer, more successful, well-liked, beautiful, but for me, I will always try to be ugly. Author unknown. It's a beautiful little piece of writing, and it just broke my heart, but I know, like a lot of you, I love my animals, you love your animals, and I really think they're better than us sometimes, but anyway, we'll move on from that. I know that's really, really hard, but yeah, it's a beautiful story, it's a beautiful story, sad but beautiful. But on to the track of the day, or the tracks of the day. Now, we've got two from the Disposable Heroes of Hip-Hopsy, and I love this record. I've played one of these tracks before, but on the concept of how we're still not having the discussions in the United States that we need to be having, and the way the media has manipulated our presidential race. This track that I've played before rang true, and I'll get Bob to play one. We'll come back, and then we'll play the other. But I was looking at the list of tracks, and I just said, "There's this other one, which is Hypocrisy is the Greatest Luxury." And after we've listened to the first track, I'll explain why I wanted to play the second track. But as a reminder of how, even as we're in this political season where everything's turned up to, you know, all eight cylinders a-blaring, we're still not on the road we're supposed to be. And television is the distraction. It lies to us constantly. It constantly diverts our attention from what we should be looking at. So, on that light, or in that light, I offer you this: television, drug of a nation. Roll it, Bob.
Well, on a brighter note,
commercial break.
The government has now banned the carrying of spears.
Stop about every 1,000 miles, ain't asking too much, is it?
You might wish to stay on and listen.
It was a place where everything was legal.
I met this woman.
So if you're looking for emotional satisfaction, my advice to you is seek professional help.
Thank you for joining us live on the air.
My pleasure.
One nation, under God, has turned into one nation under the influence of one drug. Television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV, its satellite links are United States of unconsciousness. Apathetic, therapeutic, and extremely addictive. The methadone metronome, pumping out 150 channels 24 hours a day. You can flip through all of them, and still there's nothing worth watching. TV is the reason why less than 10% of our nation reads books daily. Why most people think Central America means Kansas. Socialism means un-American, and apartheid is the new headache remedy. Absorbed in this world, it's so hard to find us. It shapes our minds the most. Maybe the mother of our nation should remind us that we're sitting too close to the television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV is a stomping ground for political candidates, where bears in the woods are chased by Grecian fawns and bald eagles. TV is mechanized politics, remote control over the masses, co-sponsored by environmentally safe gases. Watch for the PBS special. It's a perpetuation of the two-party system, where image takes precedence over wisdom, where sound by politics are served to the fast food culture, where straight teeth in your mouth are more important than the words that come out of it. Race baiting is the way to get selected. Willie Horton or will he not get elected? On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation.
On the screen is an address where you can mail your tithe offering or give the blood.
Okay, got the idea? All right, now let's talk to
Is it the reflector or the director? Does it imitate us or do we imitate it? Because a child watches 1,500 murders before he's 12 years old. And then we wonder why we created a Jason generation that learns to laugh rather than abhor the whore. TV is a place where armchair generals and quarterbacks can experience firsthand the excitement of video warfare as the theme song is sung in the background. Sugar sweet sitcoms that leave us with a bad actor taste, while pop stars metamorphosize into soda pop stars. You saw the video, you heard the soundtrack. Well, now go buy the soft drink. Well, the only cola that I support would be a Union COLA cost of living allowance. On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. Turn to our irregularly programmed schedule, hidden cleverly between heavy-breasted beer and car commercials. CNN, ESPN, ABC, BCB, TNT, but mostly BS, where oxymoronic language like virtually spotless, fresh frozen, light yet filling, and military intelligence have become standard. TV is a place where phrases are redefined,
like recessions and necessary downturns. Crude oil on a beach to moose. Civilian death to collateral damages. And being killed by your own army is now called friendly fire. TV is a place where the pursuit of happiness has become the pursuit of trivia. Where toothpaste and cars have become sex objects. Where imagination is sucked out of children by a cathode ray nipple. TV is the only wet nurse that would create a cripple. Television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance, feeding radiation. On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation.
Okay, that's the first one. Now the second one. And this, when I heard that, you know, mobile phone video audio of Bush at the gridiron thing, it made me think of this song. And I know I'm not the only one that was absolutely offended by Bush's little rewrite of that song where the American people seem to be the punchline of his goddamn joke. And when listening to that, all that rang... Now, Bob, I don't even want to hear the audio again. I think most people have heard it. If you want to check it out, go to the blog at Head On Radio Network, and you can watch it. I really, really don't want to hear that again because it got me so angry. But in response to it, I give you this. The title track of that album from 1992, written during the first Bush administration, funny how it still seems to apply, is Hypocrisy is the Greatest Luxury. Roll it, Bob.
Complex. We don't make the time to stop or reflect. I know from first-hand experience, one can go delirious. Seriously, it can be like that. But before I put my foot in my mouth, because that's what I'm about to start talking about, please let me confess before all the rest that I'm afflicted by this, addicted, like most in the U.S. It's tough to make a living when you're an artist. It's even tougher when you're socially conscious. Careerism, opportunism can turn the politics into cartoonism. Let's not patronize or criticize. Let's open the door and look inside. The following state of denial. Hypocrisy is the greatest luxury. Raise the double standard. Hypocrisy is the greatest luxury. Raise the double standard. Hypocrisy is the greatest luxury. Raise the double standard. Hypocrisy is the greatest luxury. Raise the double standard. The base, the trouble, don't make a rebel. Having your life together does. America has an image of a young one. Fast living, not giving an expletive. No respect for his or the lives of those around him. Suicidal, homicidal, or at very least extremely unbridled. How convenient for those who would like to destroy him. The problem has never been our political logic, but the way we enact it. We can imagine a perfect society that can maintain a decent relationship. The failure found in the luxury, not in the hardship. Hypocrisy is the greatest luxury. Raise the double standard. Hypocrisy is the greatest luxury. Raise the double standard. Hypocrisy is the greatest luxury.
Yes, hypocrisy is the greatest luxury. Raise the double standard. I still think that's one of the best lines ever written. I love Michael Franti. He's just phenomenal. But anyway, I've gotten that out of my system now. We'll move on to much more meaty things. I've got this interview audio from last night, and, you know, the thing that one of the many things that's frustrated me about this whole campaign in the United States is the environment has not rated more than, you know, a blip on the radar, if that, when all across the rest of the planet it's registering. And we had a tectonic shift in this country over a couple of years, where in our last election, the environment became one of the top ranking issues. And in this interview with Kathy, I think she does a very good job at explaining why this hasn't grabbed hold in the United States. And she's been here for our last election and saw what happened here. And she, through this group led or formed by Al Gore, have $300 million that they're going to throw into advertising during the presidential campaign proper. So I first was going to go and grab a few snippets from this, but I decided since this never gets any airtime in the United States, I might as well give you the entire 14 minutes unedited, because I think there's really nothing in it that isn't good. And she gets into how clean coal has there's a difference between what is referred to as clean coal in the United States and clean coal here. I thought this was just a phenomenal interview. She's doing all the media rounds here, but why do we not get this in the U.S. media? Why? That is the question. So from abc.net.au, you can see the video of this if you go to abc.net.au/7.30, and you can watch the entire interview or read the transcript, but you don't even have to do that because you can hear it right here. Roll it, Bob.
Now to our interview on the politics of global warming in the US presidential campaign. Unlike last year's federal election in Australia, the issues of climate change and global warming have barely rated a mention in the US campaign. But our next guest is attempting to change all that, and she's got a surprisingly large fund of money to do it. Once upon a time, the fossil fuel industries used economic muscle to shape public opinion. Now it appears the environmental lobby in the US has previously undreamt of resources to push opinion in a very different direction. Having worked closely with him in the White House as an environmental advisor, Kathy Zoi was recruited last year by the former Vice President Al Gore to become CEO of the Alliance for Climate Protection. I spoke to her in our Sydney studio just a short time ago. Kathy Zoi, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Now, we sometimes make the mistake in this country because of Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in California and so on, of thinking that American public opinion attracts that those kind of gentlemen and the views that they have. It appears that it does not.
We have a very high level of awareness in the United States now, largely because of people like Al Gore and Arnold Schwarzenegger. That awareness, though, hasn't translated into it being a voting priority issue for Americans. Recent polling of last month, out of 22 public policy issues that Americans were asked about, global warming, climate change came in 21st, nearly at the bottom.
And it also seems that that particular disinterest is mirrored, if you like, by the reporters who are following around the candidates in this presidential election.
Well, again, that's right. A group did a study during this presidential primary season, and I think everybody in Australia would say, my gosh, why does it go on so long? But it does. 3,200 questions have been asked by the top TV reporters. 8 of them have been about global warming, climate change. That's it. So the reporters aren't asking. With that said, the 3 contenders left in the race have decent policy platforms that they've made campaign pledges that are pretty good, that are a dramatic departure from what we've had for the past 8 years.
But they don't talk about it.
They don't know. They don't talk about it. In fact, Hillary Clinton was in a forum in November where she looked at the audience and said, you know, you guys might find this hard to believe because it was a lot of environmentalists, but nobody asks me about this. So,
Oddly enough, when you compare the Democrats, Clinton and Obama, to John McCain on the issue of global warming, he's the one who comes out looking more like the visionary, if you like.
Well, he has been a visionary in Washington. He, many years ago, discovered it as a problem, studied it, and was one of the first members of the Senate, even as a Republican, to introduce legislation, which hasn't yet passed, but he's a co-signatory to the bill, the Lieberman-Warner bill right now. He has said that it will be one of his top three issues, or he has said in the past it will be one of his top three issues. I think perhaps now that he's having to garner more support from the conservative base of the Republican Party, that may go by the wayside, but we can try to hold him to it. Both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have really strong platforms. I mean, the interesting thing now is what's written down is what you say in Australia is much of a muchness. I mean, McCain supports nuclear power as part of the solution. The two Democrats don't. They all are for investments in innovation and having the government support clean energy. They all are. The Democrats tend to be more interested in making sure working families don't get harmed in any way by the transition. I mean, those are all sort of predictable things, but by and large, they're all supporting binding caps in greenhouse gas emissions, which, as we know, George Bush has run away from.
So why the disconnect between public interest and public policy?
There's a number of reasons. I thought a lot about this because I was here in Australia for 12 years, and it was just a wonder and a pleasure to watch what happened in the recent federal election here, where climate change became a top priority voting issue for everyday people in Australia. So I thought a little bit about the differences. And I guess several things. In Australia, the drought was felt by everybody. Absolutely, whether you're in the city or the country, it was felt by everybody. And in America, there are certain pieces of the United States that have had impacts. Katrina, New Orleans, obviously devastated. The Southeast and the Southwest have had some drought. In the Southeast, though, the governor of Georgia recently, in response to the drought and they're running out of water in Atlanta, invited people to the Capitol steps for a prayer meeting to pray for rain, which is a kind of a quintessentially piece of America sort of response. There have been wildfires, but across the United States, by and large, the impacts, folks haven't connected the dots on the impacts. I think in Australia as well, we've had more experience tangibly with renewable energy. I mean, you know, New South Wales came up with the world's first green power program. The mandatory renewable energy target that was put in place a few years ago at the Commonwealth level means that every you know, power company in Australia has some experience with renewable energy. Again, that's not the case in the United States. So Americans don't have a sense that necessarily this is solvable. So here's this specter of, oh my gosh, Al Gore's told us there's a problem and we believe him. But the psychology of getting them on board, they need to understand that, look, this is a mobilization issue. It's not a technology issue.
Have U.S. campaign strategists looked at what happened in the Australian election, particularly in that last year or so before the election, and how the issues swung around and became important? Have they thought about that and as a way of using it politically themselves?
Well, I don't know if they have inside the campaigns. I know that I've written political columns for papers in Washington, D.C. I know Al Gore talks a lot about it because he spent a fair amount of time in Australia in the period leading up to the election and feels quite fondly about how the Australian electorate has sort of made it a priority issue. So we, Al Gore and I, in our work with the Alliance for Climate Protection, are hoping to translate the lessons here, the work here, the campaigning here, the business leadership here, into the debate in the United States. Because, after all, if we do not successfully get the American people to raise this up the priority level, then whoever's elected president won't make it their priority. I mean, there's a difference that's so fundamental in the Westminster system and the system that the founding fathers of the United States have uniquely developed for America, and that is that even if we have a Democratic White House and a Democratic Congress, each of those members of Congress still votes individually for their electorate. There's no unified party platform. So there's no automatic, yes, we will pass legislation to control climate, you know, to solve the climate crisis.
You've actually worked in the White House, so you know how few issues a president can deal with in a single term.
Absolutely. And frankly, you'd be hard-pressed to find two stronger advocates for solving the climate crisis than Al Gore and Bill Clinton, and that was my time in the White House. we worked hard on that Kyoto Agreement. You know, we went over to Kyoto, you know, got a really pretty, like a strong deal, but that worked for the U.S. economy at that time. Came back to Washington, and the next step by U.S., by the U.S. Constitution is you have to take that piece of paper, that treaty, and take it to the Senate and get the Senate, because the Senate is responsible for ratifying treaties. We walked up to Capitol Hill, and essentially the Senate said, no way, we don't want to have a bar of this. You know, you're kidding me. But the scientists are telling us it's necessary. We just got this deal in Japan. Everybody else is on board. And what the Senate members said is, look, our voters aren't asking about this.
You're now in the business of changing public opinion.
And, I hope so.
And lobbying, presumably, in the political process. But you're, one of the first steps, as I understand it, you're going to go through is an advertising campaign. First of all, how much money do you have to do that as a television advertising campaign?
Well, we've got an integrated campaign, and a piece of that is paid media. I mean, we're combining paid media, which will include television, but it'll also include being online, because you can't do anything with paid media these days without having really interesting online advertising. We're combining that with grassroots mobilization and an online organizing hub. So it's all of those things together. But with respect to how much it's going to be, the number that's been floating out there and that's in our early budgets is roughly $300 million. But for us, it's not that. It's
$300 million.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that compare with, for example, an ad buy for a political candidate vying to become president?
It's actually small. I mean, it sounds big in the Australian context. I mean, the Climate Institute here has a similar mission to the Alliance for Climate Protection and has been very, very successful with a budget of $10 million. So things are expensive in the United States, and television is expensive in the United States. What we've done with our budgeting, and again, it's just preliminary, we're going to invest as much money as is required to shift public opinion, frankly, because the scientists tell us we don't have much time. Scientists say we've got somewhere between 7 and 10 years to turn emissions around and start going down. We don't have time for this to organically take hold bit by bit. We've got to sort of get into people's living rooms. And Americans, on average, watch 4.5 hours of television a day. So if you're going to reach them with good information, you're going to have to get to them partially through their television.
You're also going to have to get the presidential candidates to start talking about this as a frontline issue, aren't you? And the other question that they need to answer is, if they have these targets, do they have economic plans to actually meet the targets?
And I think they do. Well, I know that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama do. I know that in their platforms they invest a fairly substantial amount of time on investments, providing investment incentives for companies to get into clean energy. So I think Hillary has a $50 billion plan and Barack has said a $25 to $50 billion plan. Both of the Democratic candidates also have talked about setting up a fund to ensure that working families, that the less fortunate, are not made worse off if indeed energy prices shift a bit. And so, we fully support that, but that's actually quite doable to ensure that if there's some sort of cap and an ensuing price on carbon, it shouldn't be the little guys that are actually harmed by this. We, you know, just like with any social program, we need to ensure that the families are okay.
So the thought is tax cuts of some sort for people who get hit, particularly at the lower end, by higher power costs.
You can do it with a tax cut. You can do it with a fee assistance scheme. There are any number of sort of mechanisms to make that happen. But the point is, you don't want working families to be worse off. What you want is up the food chain for the investments decisions in all of the new power stations to go towards clean energy and away from carbon polluting energy.
Well, that is a huge problem in the United States, isn't it? As in China, as in Australia and many other places that are heavily reliant on coal-fired power stations. The United States has a huge number on the drawing board. Are you going to attempt to stop them being built?
Well, what our official platform is that we need to have a moratorium on new coal unless it can safely capture the CO2. And the 60,000 megawatts of plants that are on the drawing board in over 40 of the 50 states don't have CCS. So I guess the direct answer to your question is, you bet. We want to make sure we're happy to have coal with CCS get built. We love that, and we think it's part of the future. But we cannot afford to have billions of dollars invested in capital plant that should last 50 years in an old-fashioned, outdated technology.
So one of the main targets, I imagine, that you have is for the presidential candidates to commit that none of these power stations will be allowed to be built if they don't have carbon capture and storage.
That's right. And instead...
Clean coal, as they call it.
clean coal. Clean coal. Well, in America, they don't mean CCS when they say clean coal. There are a lot of euphemisms flying around. There's a bit of Orwellian word gaming that's happening. There's a group called the Americans for Balanced Energy Choices. And what they say is that coal is 70% cleaner than it was 30 years ago, but they're not talking about the carbon pollution. So okay. It's a bit disingenuous.
Well, how do you then convince all these states that are planning to build coal-fired power stations with no carbon capture and storage to do otherwise?
Well, one of the things that we've got in place right now that needs to be extended is a renewable energy investment tax credit. And what that has been able to do, and I'll give you some examples, because it's an Australian technology. In California, they're putting in solar thermal, okay, essentially. Sun hits the Mojave Desert, heats up mirrors heat up water, water uses a boiler and you make electricity. That technology was developed by a Sydney University professor who has moved to Silicon Valley. He's been funded by Silicon Valley venture capitalists. He's going to have big business. There are thousands of megawatts of potential. All of that new, if you filled up a parcel of land in the Mojave Desert in southern Nevada, let's say 100 miles by 100 miles, theoretically, you could meet all of U.S. electricity demand, all of it. Now, we're not suggesting that that's what you do, but...
Because this is the big argument that's been going on in this country and many other countries for a very long time. There's no renewable energy source that can provide baseload power for cities.
And what David Mills and his team at OSRA have done is they have figured out a way to store the energy so it is the same as a baseload plant. It's brilliant. It's wonderful. And we're really excited that this very good Aussie talent has moved to the U.S.
Final question, Kathy Zoy. There's a lot of talk about targets for 2050, very little talk from the politicians who matter, from the power brokers, about interim targets. How important is it to set interim targets quickly?
I think it's incredibly important. I think that if we're going to have an argument at all, it shouldn't be about what the 2050 target is. I think what we need is material targets by 2020. We need all new energy to be clean, to be carbon free. And once we get going on that, this whole scale transformation of the energy economy is going to take off. It's going to be lucrative, interesting, fun, and it will mean that your children and my children, polluting energy will be a non-issue by the time they're grown up.
Kathy Zoy, we certainly hope that's true, and we'll wait to see, obviously. But thank you very much for coming in to talk to us tonight.
My pleasure.
All right, that was from last night's Late Line on the Australian ABC. And see, environmental news and developments can be exciting. Did you hear the energy in this woman's voice? And what she was speaking about there with the geothermal thing is the solar geothermal system that I've been talking about for at least a year now. The closed system, it's Australian technology, now being developed in the United States. We have plants like this in Spain and in California. And this can create base load electricity generation 24/7 with, after construction of the space, zero carbon emissions. This stuff works. So you've heard it here. Before you hear it even in the United States, you've heard it here. There's $300 million set aside to push the climate issue in the American election campaign. And I can see why they're obviously still developing their plans. And they're obviously going to wait until after the until the conventions are over and when we get into the election proper. So you've heard it here first, and it's going to be a multi-level campaign, television, radio, internet with a hub for organization. This is the kind of stuff that we need, that we need. And as you know, I know Nanette in the chat room, she hears clean coal, she just about wants to rip her hair out. And I don't blame her. And it's interesting, you catch there, Kathy mentions the fact that what they talk about clean coal here is something very different than what's in the United States. Here they're talking purely about carbon storage and capture, which is still a myth. Still hasn't been done. No one's been able to do it. So until someone can actually make it happen, it should be considered exactly that, a pipe dream. Now, this is the stuff that doesn't get covered in the U.S. media. And, I mean, the only reason that we actually get it here in Australia the way that we do is because we have the ABC, which, being the people's broadcaster, doesn't need, you know, commercial funding. They don't have sponsors that they have to, you know, kiss ass to. Now, my good friend Scott Barry just pulled up here, and he informed me of something very interesting. Now, Scott's a very, very cluey guy, and things don't slide by him much, and this is one of the reasons why he's a good friend of mine. He catches the subtleties. He said he was watching a bit of the primary coverage from the United States, and they were doing a piece on Hillary and Obama, and when they were doing Hillary, they were playing underneath from Nine Inch Nails the track Closer. Started off with the little piano melody, a little further in, it's into the groove. But yet, what might the subtext be? If you're familiar with Nine Inch Nails, and I know David from Maine is, what's the hook from that song there, David? I wanna hurt you like an animal. Now, I'm not sure which network this might have been from that Scott saw this, but, you know, I could definitely see the... Oh, it was from Fox. Okay, well, that pretty much sums it up right there. A little bit of subtlety, we're going to do a thing, but if Hillary gets in, you're fucked. That's what she's saying. That's what they were saying. Subtly with music. And I thank you for that, mate. I mean, this is why, you know, we referred to the debates on this network as pageants. They've been an absolute joke. You know, and when only 8 out of 3,800 questions that have been posed to these candidates and all these pageants, only 8 have dealt with the environment? Again, you have debates sponsored by Friends of Coal. You're never going to get debate on these issues. And any right-winger or anyone in the media who says, oh, it doesn't matter who's sponsoring them, has their head up their ass. Or they have a vested interest in something. I really want to go back to 30 years ago when the networks all broadcast the debates, and they were set up by independent groups. You know, we have the voting machines. It's like the entire process has been sold off to corporate interests. This is not democracy. And Kathy Zoi, the excitement that you hear from her when she spoke about what happened here in Australia, how things like the environment really, really, you know, were right up at the top of the pile of issues. And it meant something to somebody. And I think one of the key factors is the fact that the drought here has affected virtually every single Australian, whether you live out in the bush or whether you live in the city. Unfortunately, in the United States, it's pockets. New Orleans, decimated. But then again, there's so much distraction on that issue because of the mess that has been left behind by the politics involved in the cleanup. But you heard it here first. There is going to be, as it stands now, and I imagine there will be even more money thrown into it as time goes on, but $300 million, which is a drop in the bucket when you think about it in American terms. However, it should buy a fair bit of TV time. Now, let's see where the situations when Fox or MSNBC or the GE network decide that, oh, we can't air your commercial because it's a little too this or that, like we've seen during the Super Bowl, where certain political groups have been told, oh, you know what, we can't air that ad. We find it offensive to our small-mindedness. Jesus. I'm telling you, it's this lack of reality, lack of dealing with facts and science that is going to absolutely destroy not only the United States, but the rest of this planet. We keep walking around going, oh, it's all fine, we're going to do this thing, and, you know, and, oh, don't worry about it. You're all...
I'm informed that a duck-billed platypus just stepped on John's connection. He will be back momentarily. We lost you there, John.
Yeah. I noticed you lost me there, Bob. What a drag. How long was I gone?
About 2.5 minutes.
Oh, what a drag.
Yeah, you were just firing up real good.
Okay, well, let's get back to it. Actually, Bob, don't go away. I was mentioning how this fund that we're going to start seeing the work of in the election with Catherine and whatnot. Of $300 million. Scott just hands me, writes down, he goes, U.S. defense expenditure in Iraq calculated at over $3 trillion today from ABC News.
Yeah, $6 trillion if it goes on for another 3 years, I think.
And how we don't have some sort of connection to the reality that we could spend a whole hell of a lot less money trying to secure oil supplies if we invested some of this money into new forms of energy like the global geothermal, like I've been talking about for...
No argument here, John, but see, the problem is ExxonMobil and Royal Dutch Shell and BP and all these other companies that
people like Dick Cheney and George Bush and the entire administration are heavily invested in, have made no overtures whatsoever toward getting into what will be a very, very lucrative field. So they don't care. They are in eat, drink, and be merry, tomorrow we die mode.
Oh yeah, I have no doubt about that. And this is, you know, I mean, this all boils down to this unitary executive kind of crap, and the fact that we no longer have people at the moment that actually represent us in government. So this woman saying that actually it seems in the United States that people in general are starting to actually get it. Now the religious wing nutters and those with the financial vested interest, you know, you set them aside. But, you know, the average American is starting to catch on that, hey, you know, something's a bit not happening here. But yet it's still not translating to the debate. And is that somehow our fault? Are we not getting them to talk about it? Or are these events now so staged and so filtered and everyone so screened that no one walking up with a, you know, Save the Earth t-shirt actually gets into a Hillary Clinton event?
Or Obama. Yeah, it's some of the, all of the above. Some of all of the above, there we go. Because you gotta dig it, okay? The amount of money that Ms. Zoe and her organization are going to spend on this ad blitz is less than one day's profits for ExxonMobil. Guess what? They'll spend dollar for dollar. Now, I'm not trying to be Mr. Gloom and Doom, but
I know that.
But we're now part of the reality-based community, right?
Oh, absolutely. So, and the reality is whatever any group trying to put across the reality and the facts will be able to put across. ExxonMobil, Americans for Balanced Energy Choices and bullshit organizations like that will spend 10 times as much to try and counter it.
Exactly. And you know, I think we were talking in the horn section about what it looks like. We need real-world modeling that the so-called soccer moms and security moms and softball dads and whatever, you know, Parcheesi uncles or whatever can get their heads around.
Parcheesi, I haven't heard that in a while. Yeah, we need Yahtzee type stuff to get through.
Well,
to these folks,
in a way, people flocked to use the obligatory Australian reference. People flocked to the Mad Max movies because they were sort of exciting, because they were all post-apocalyptic and stuff. And we got to walk away from the movie saying, "Wow, yeah, but I mean that'll never happen." But a lot of us walked away from those movies saying, "We're on the road to that," and you know,
absolutely.
Maybe ultimately the movie about the Bush administration gets titled Beyond Blunderdome.
Beyond Blunderdome. I like that. I do like that.
What I'm getting at is we need movies that, or we need some way of the American people getting its head around what it's going to look like and what it's going to feel like, and it can't all be barren landscapes and we need some sort of a narrative, John, of how we get from here to there and what my grandkids' adult life looks like if we don't quit effing up so bad.
Well, I think that the first two resources for doing such a film or a project are, I heard Gunny Bob on your show mention The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight from Tom Hartman.
Yeah.
And the other one, because even though the first third of that book is really, really rough to read, because it's all kind of the road on how we got here and what the hell we're doing. And then there's the politics. And then the last third of the book is dealing with what we can do to make the changes we need. Now, I haven't read the updated version. My version's a couple years old. The other one is the now former Australian of the Year, his book, The Weathermakers, which does a beautiful job in explaining how this whole thing with climate science isn't new. it's been actually going on for a couple of centuries now, that the connection between carbon increases and a changing climate are not new. And there, we don't have to have a barren planet. If we keep doing what we're doing, yes, we're going to have a barren planet. At least it'll be barren when we die off, and then it'll come back to life, and something new will take our place. But this is it. I think people need to understand that this is about human survival, not the planet's survival.
Yeah, yeah.
And when we clean up our act, we're going to have a much nicer place to live. Because at the moment, it's killing us. It's killing us slowly.
Yeah. Do you see what I'm saying about being creative in giving that imagery? You're not gonna get the guy who gets home exhausted from work to sit down and read The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. If, however, you craft a television program or something along those lines and make it real for him, because most people are John, I would guess that you are an auditory learner, and as such you are a rarity. I'm an auditory learner. I learn as I hear. Most people learn as they see. And we've got we've got to visualize it for them.
Right. I understand what you mean, and I'm actually more visual than you might expect. However, I totally see your point, and it shames me to say that it appears that the American populace is far more shallow than the Australian populace, when I didn't actually expect that I'd be saying that when it comes to this issue.
Well, you live in a much more fragile environment, and because it's a smaller country and it's landlocked, but it's isolated in the way that it is, you have to confront your realities in a far more serious fashion. We don't. I mean, we're America. We'll take it from you, because God loves us.
How'd you get moved on top of our oil?
Yeah, what's that sand doing on our oil?
Yeah,
you gotta say it like
but,
that.
You know,
oil.
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 But, you know, it'll be interesting to see, okay, if they've got $300 million now, that's their startup capital for just the media angle of it. Now, this is an extension of basically an investment group in environmental technologies. So it's obviously not all the money that they've got. So
now,
this is just the media effort. And this is their starting capital. Once they launch this thing, and I think if it's anything like she's describing, folks like us, like all of the blogs and whatnot that deal with these issues, need to get on board and utilize this hub. And I think you will see people donating into this organization.
Well, hey, we're the horn. We'll pull it like a little red wagon, John.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, I'm going to be very interested. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, on the other hand, we got to go.
Yes, we do. So with that, we'll pick this back up tomorrow. Don't forget, Thursday night, Travis Meeks here on the show. Thanks to Bob for producing. Thanks to Scott Barry at B1 Ladder Productions for the music. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch for everything that they do. And as we say here on Foxed Up, be good, be green. We'll see you tomorrow.
And the sign said, long-haired freaky people need not apply.